Hello and welcome to this special Memorial Day edition of Inside Politics. I'm Manu Raju, in for John King in Washington. Honoring their sacrifice, the president marking this Memorial Day with a stop at the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier and with an address thanking troops who gave their last full measure of devotion to the country they serve. Plus, a debt deal if they can sell it. The text of Biden-McCarthy deal is now out. The president and the speaker must find a Goldilocks road now to get it to the president's desk. And Chris Sununu says he'll decide soon on a 2024 run. But is the field already overcrowded for everyone not named Donald Trump? But up first for us, a salesmanship test for the president of the United States and the Republican House Speaker. The pair are striking a deal to avoid going over the debt cliff. But now comes the hard part. Mr. Biden must convince Democrats he didn't give away too much. And Mr. McCarthy must convince Republicans he extracted just enough. The deal's text is now public, released late last night. And this morning, new optimism that the middle out strategy will get enough members on board to push the deal across the finish line. But there are already loud complaints, too. Progressives say the president opened up the door to draconian restrictions on work requirements. Hardline Republicans insist their speaker only got a tiny slice of what they wanted. So for all of this, let's get straight to CNN's Lauren Fox on Capitol Hill. So, Lauren, break down this deal for us and tell us what the path ahead is.
Well, Manu, this deal certainly cut between Biden and McCarthy in the middle of what both sides wanted. It raises the debt ceiling for 2 years through January 1st, 2025. It also imposes new work requirements on social safety net programs, claws back some of that unspent COVID money, about $28 billion, and rescinds some of the money that was going to go to the IRS for more IRS agents. That's about $20 billion. But like you noted, this is when the sales game begins. You are already seeing furious efforts to whip this bill, with Republicans trying to get votes from some of their members. Meanwhile, some conservatives are already arguing that this bill does not go far enough, that the spending cuts are not significant enough. We're going to see the first test tomorrow in the Rules Committee. That is when we expect to see whether or not a number of conservatives who serve on that committee are going to support the rule or not. That'll be the first test. Then it goes to the floor of the House on Wednesday. Meanwhile, Democrats have their own work cut out for them. The White House is doing a series of detailed briefings today, trying to convince members, trying to help them understand why this is the best deal that the president could get. After this passes, or if this passes out of the House of Representatives, then it goes to the Senate. And that is another fight entirely. This could push, of course, up to that June 5th deadline if any one Republican or Democratic senator decides to drag out this process. Manu?
Yeah, and it could put them right up against that June 5th deadline to avert first ever default here in the country's history. Lauren Fox, thank you so much. And here with me in the room, our panel, CNN's Jeff Zeleny, Mariana Sotomayor of The Washington Post, and Tia Mitchell of the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. So, you know, we have heard some opposition building on the right and the left. Probably the loudest opposition so far has been the conservatives. They have really taken to Twitter. Some have gone on air and really railed against it. Just some of them. Ralph Norman, congressman, says he called it insanity. Chip Roy called it a turd sandwich. Dan Bishop said Zippo. And Ken Buck called it a major win for Joe Biden. Now, Ken Buck, he voted against this bill and the Republican bill that went much further back in April. The other three actually voted for that Republican bill. How do you see this conservative opposition playing out here in the days ahead? And how much of a risk is it for McCarthy?
Well, I know you know this, but there are many conservatives out there who have already expected that a majority of the Freedom Caucus, there's about 33 of them, will likely vote no. That's always been the starting gate. What McCarthy really needs is the majority of the majority. It was actually a promise, not necessarily written in stone, but during the speakership week, that any bill that is brought to the floor needs to have a solid amount of Republican support. That means he can lose 111 Republicans. That's a pretty hefty amount, and it gives a lot of these conservatives the space to say, I don't like this because of all of these different reasons. But then when you get to the math, you obviously would need 107 Democrats. Mm-hmm. The thing, though, of course, with these Freedom Caucus members is they obviously have the option to vacate McCarthy. Yeah. So, sure, you could lose their votes, but they still want to be seen and heard. And that's a lot of the things that I know you and I will be watching this
week.
Yeah,
it's going to be really interesting to see. We do know these Freedom Caucus members are strategizing about their way ahead. They may not have the numbers to stop it. But look, this is what the risk that McCarthy took, and he won the speakership. He cut this deal to allow a single member to call for a vote to seek his ouster. And any member who was angry could do it. And then McCarthy would need 218 votes on the House floor. That means losing no more than four Republicans to maintain his speakership. That has to be weighing on him. He says he's not concerned about it. He told reporters yesterday, I'm not concerned about losing my speakership over it. But this is the first real test of Republican division in his speakership.
Right. And so the test to me is not just will they support the bill, but in the next few days, as they watch how McCarthy whips votes, as they watch what happens in the Rules Committee, as they watch what happens as the bill heads to the floor, will they start saying they're displeased with his leadership? We already have seen some conservatives saying they didn't think he did a good job in the negotiating room with President Biden. They think he didn't fight hard enough. I was speaking to Representative Andrew Clyde, who's one of those kind of hardliners. And even on Thursday, as they were planning to recess, he was saying, I want Kevin McCarthy to keep fighting for our Republican bill. Don't settle for anything less. So, of course, they're disappointed. But are they at the point where they're ready to kind of, you know, execute this plan to remove McCarthy? We know that's unlikely to happen, but they could toy with him a little bit, make it difficult, embarrassing. But right now, it's not clear if they're willing to go that
far. And look, up until this point, the speaker has done a good job of keeping those folks on the far right on his side. He's really, I remember Matt Gaetz told me not too long ago they'd give Kevin McCarthy an A for his job as speaker. And this is a person who went after, trying to prevent him from becoming speaker, said he would never become speaker. And look, he won him over. Now they're going to be divided. This is what McCarthy had tried to avoid. There are serious divisions, though, on the Democratic side, too. I mean, the Republicans are upset that there were not enough concessions. The Democrats, they were listening to the White House. They said, we weren't going to concede on anything. We're going to just demand a clean debt ceiling increase. And here are a whole host of concessions that they made. And listen to Pramila Jayapal. She is the chairwoman of the Congressional Progressive Caucus, someone who, and like other progressives, are not happy about a lot of the concessions the White House made.
It is really unfortunate that the president opened the door to this. And while at the end of the day, you know, perhaps this will, because of the exemptions, perhaps it will be okay. I can't commit to that. I really don't know.
And she was talking about, in particular, the work requirements that were added as part of the food stamp program. It expanded the work requirements to this deal that was cut between Biden and Republicans. But this shows you the challenges that he has on his left and the tension with him and his party.
No question. And those challenges have really been there throughout his presidency. But they are about to perhaps be more stinging than we've seen them before. And a couple different things are in play. Ron Klain, who was the White House chief of staff at the time, did a very good job during the first half of the first term of keeping progressives informed in the loop and also sort of at bay that, you know, being pragmatic is sort of what you need. He's missing from this equation. So we'll see how the left actually fares on this. But some of them actually believed what the president was saying and the White House was saying is we're not going to negotiate on this.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the reality is that was never going to work.
They've negotiated debt ceiling.
It's not how things work here. The president obviously knew that. I mean, he was definitely trying to negotiate as he was saying, we're not going to negotiate.
Right.
So he thought that Republicans would fracture. Mm-hmm. That's what they thought all along, that Republicans would not be able to stay together. They did stay together up until now. We'll see if they do over the next week or so. But look, I find it hard to believe that the left would not be there for him. He's their president.
Yeah.
He's facing a re-election. It's really hard for me to imagine that only more than a handful would support it.
Exactly. Into the point of miscalculating on what the Republicans would do. They didn't think, Chuck Schumer said, they're not going to be able to pass a bill in the House. They passed a bill in April. He kept saying, show us your plan, show us your plan. They showed him a plan, and then they passed the bill, and because of that, they had so much more leverage with the White House going forward. And this is what one Senate Democrat told me last night after they got briefed by the White House. He said, it's not a victory, but it's a lot better than what might have happened if there were defaults. So they're kind of just going to hold their nose and kind of and vote for it. Congressman Jim Himes, who is a member, not one of the lefties in the Democratic caucus, said this yesterday about the prospects of doing that, holding his nose and voting yes.
It's a small enough bill that in the service of actually not destroying the economy this week may get Democratic votes. I'm tempted to say, no, I'm in no vote, because as the speaker said, there is absolutely nothing for the Democrats in these things. And oh, by the way, do I really want to validate a process which at the end of the day is a hostage-taking process, even if I get to use it 2 years from now?
I mean, that is the hope among the White House here, that members like Jim Himes will say, all right, I have to vote first because there's no other option. What am I going to do? Default, see the economy, the first debt default in American history? Because this is the only option, and it's a bad option for a lot of Democrats.
Absolutely. And here's the thing that both McCarthy has said privately and also the White House is starting to tell Democrats. Elections have consequences. You have to come to the negotiating table in divided government. And you're now starting to hear both of those different sides also trying to play into 2024 politics, saying, hey, you're a Republican and you want to see more cuts, you better keep us in the majority. Mm-hmm. Well, Democrats are going out there and starting to say, and this is something that Shalonda Young actually said on the call to Democrats yesterday, well, we all need to go out there, talk about the economy and say that we have saved it in all these different ways, kept in place a number of the bipartisan bills that Biden was able to sign into law, and still go out there, motivate voters, tell them to elect Biden and also win back the majority.
Yeah,
House Dems only need five votes.
That's a big deal. I mean, the Inflation Reduction Act is kept in place. So I think that is going to assuage a lot of these progressive concerns. I mean, it's a negotiation. So I think you can obviously argue both sides. But I mean, the fact that they did not sort of redo all his progress from the first half of his administration, it's a pretty big deal.
I mean, that's actually what one of the members told me who got off that call yesterday, said that 99% of that White House briefing was about what was not included as part of it. So they are arguing that it could have been worse. I do want you to listen to what the president said, and along with Speaker McCarthy, about how they're messaging this to their respective bases.
Mr. President, what do you say to members of your own party who say you've made too many concessions in this deal?
They'll find I didn't.
I think you're going to get a majority of Republicans voting for this bill. This is a good bill for the American public. The president agreed with this bill. So I think there's going to be a lot of Democrats that go vote for it, too.
I mean, at his heart, the president is a deal maker, is a negotiator, which is why a lot of Democrats were concerned when he was in the room with Speaker McCarthy.
Yeah, I do think there is a little bit of relief from Democrats, if they want to be honest, that it wasn't. It could have been worse is what I think the Biden White House is selling. And I think a lot of Democrats kind of agree with that. The cuts, the budget cuts that Republicans had in their bill that they said they were not going to back away from. Well, ultimately, what is in this agreement is it's much less. It's pretty much flat government spending. Mm-hmm. It's only for a couple of years. And then beyond that, it's kind of and agreed upon, but not binding. Those are things that I think Democrats were really concerned that there were going to be steep cuts. Medicaid was another place where Biden said, hey, I did not agree to any changes with Medicaid. That was something that Republicans really wanted to implement work requirements for Medicaid, which is health care for the poor and disabled.
Yeah, and look, it's clear the White House wants to put this chapter behind them, pass this, move on to the next issue. But a lot of Republicans didn't want to put this issue. They wanted a one-year debt limit increase to fight it again next year. And that's one of the things that McCarthy has to convince them why he agreed to suspend the debt limit until January 2025. Okay, up next for us, New Hampshire's governor considering jumping into the 2024 race for president. Will a crowded Republican field, though, help Donald Trump? GOP presidential candidate Ron DeSantis joining the chorus of right-wing Republicans saying the agreement to raise the debt ceiling is a bad deal.
Prior to this deal, Kaylee, our country was careening towards bankruptcy. And after this deal, our country will still be careening towards bankruptcy. In Washington, D.C., they do these cycles to just get them through the next election. And that's ultimately one of the reasons why they continue to fail.
And this week, DeSantis will hold his first events as an official candidate in Iowa, New Hampshire, and South Carolina. The former president also headed to Iowa. Now, our panel is back. Jeff, you're hitting the road. You're going to be in Des Moines tomorrow. What is going to be DeSantis's challenge when he starts to engage with voters there?
Well, first, it will be his official kickoff. Talk about someone who's had multiple bites of the apple here. I mean, it didn't go so well last week on Twitter, so he'll be doing an actual rally in Des Moines. And look, there are many Republican voters out there who are exhausted by the former president and are looking for someone who can take him on and beat him. Well, this will be the first opportunity for him in a rally-like setting to really show what he's made of. For the last several days, he's been doing something on conservative talk radio stations across the country in a lot of interviews, going after the former president on his ideology and his conservative agenda. He was talking about his spending plan, how much money he added to the debt, immigration, how he didn't build the wall, all these things. So we'll see if he actually is that forceful when he's in person at this rally. But look, a lot of Republicans are wanting to see if he is a strong enough candidate. But at the same time, this is getting to be, as we head into June here, the race is now just underway.
Yeah.
It's not at the end. It's not even at the middle. It's just underway here. So a lot of voters are going to take their time to size up these candidates and see, you know, sort of who in the Never Trump lane looks good. But that lane's getting pretty crowded, of course, which helps the Trump lane.
And Iowa's getting crowded, too. If you put that map back up on our screen, you can see the number of candidates who are going to be in Iowa in just this week alone. And DeSantis is having his kickoff rally in Des Moines. There's a Trump campaign event in Sean Hannity and Town Hall on Thursday in Iowa. Joni Ernst is hosting several of these candidates, potential candidates like Mike Pence, Tim Scott, Nikki Haley, Asa Hutchinson, Vivek Ramaswamy, all in Iowa. I want you to listen, though, to how Ron DeSantis is trying to separate himself, saying that he is a winner, not just one term, but two terms.
Everyone knows if I'm the nominee, I will beat Biden, and I will serve two terms, and I will be able to destroy leftism in this country and leave woke ideology on the dustbin of history. At the end of the day, I've shown in Florida an ability to win huge swaths of voters that Republicans typically can't win while also delivering the boldest agenda.
Is that enough to separate him from this very crowded field?
I think as he speaks, I'm sure that there are conservatives who are listening who say, I like what he says. I wonder, though, as the media, as his Republican opponents, and should he become the nominee or draw attention from Democrats, as Democrats start to really dig into Ron DeSantis's record, dig even into those wins at the polls, what do they really tell us? What is his coalition? What is the factors? What are the factors that played into that? And that exposure, that digging deep that he really hasn't faced, I think that is where he could face some headwind.
Mm-hmm. And look, this is how the New York Times put it, is he's getting a more crowded field, DeSantis, because he is trying to vie to be that anti-Trump candidate or the person as a Trump alternative, but it's crowded. This is what it says. Each new entrant threatens to steal a small piece of Mr. DeSantis's potential coalition, whether it be Mr. Pence with Iowa evangelicals or Mr. Scott with college-educated suburbanites. Trump's base, more than 30% of Republicans, remain strongly devoted to him. So his effort to try to become that alternative, challenging.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It seems like DeSantis is trying to be, you know, try and capture the Trumpism without the Trump baggage, which a lot of voters during the midterm said, you know, I'm a Republican through and through, but I just don't know if Trump should run again. We've obviously seen Trump again surge in the polls, kind of come back with force. And it's true that the more people that get in, as we saw in 2016, it just helps Trump in the primaries. Mm-hmm. And of course, DeSantis' team has said, you know, this isn't 2016. It's a different landscape. I'm trying to make, or at least show that contrast of, these are the promises, to your point, Jeff, that Trump said he would finish and do, but he wasn't able to get done.
Yeah, and look, we see more of these candidates in the race. Just yesterday, Chris Sununu, the New Hampshire governor, indicated he's got a big decision to make.
The one thing I'm looking at is, where can I be most effective, and both in terms of making sure I can be a good governor. I still have a 24/7 job. I'm one of the few people that I still very much focus on my state. I just want what's best for the party. It doesn't have to be the Chris Sununu show all the time.
I mean, how does a candidate like Chris Sununu, who has some appeal, no doubt, he's obviously from New Hampshire, the second race, the second state here in the primary calendar, but how does someone like him gain traction in a race like this?
It's a real tough road. The road is crowded already. And to me, that sounded like, you know, the reverse indicator was sort of on his car there, and he's beeping backwards. It doesn't have to be the Chris Sununu show. That, to me, seems like he's looking for an off-ramp not to run. I was in New Hampshire about a week and a half ago talking to a lot of Republicans, including his father, John Sununu, and he said, you know, we'll see, but he has a day job, and he could be more effective in the party as a messenger. So we'll see. If he gets in, it will change the equation in New Hampshire. I mean, he is not the front runner necessarily, mm-hmm. but he could really occupy that never Trump lane and cause some issues for others. But yeah. He's been an interesting voice, though, in this race, and I think he'll continue to be. He was one of the first Republicans to criticize Governor DeSantis on his Disney stance, mm-hmm. kind of led the way on that, yeah. saying this isn't conservative. How is this a conservative philosophy going after a private business? So regardless of if he runs or not, his voice will be heard in this race.
In national Republicans, he doesn't really register on the dial. You saw the poll that we showed you a little bit earlier, but 53% of Republicans see Trump as their clear choice, top choice. DeSantis, about half of that. Then you got Pence and Nikki Haley. I mean, so much of this is about name recognition and being able to, you know, have the money to be able to convince the voters that you can actually win here.
Right. And that, to me, is the test for Ron DeSantis as well. As he gets out there, he's an official candidate now because his hands were tied a little bit in the recent months. But now that he's actually campaigning, he's going to show up at those rallies. Will he be able to increase his level of support? Because right now, Trump is besting him in the polls 2-1. So he's got a lot of ground to make up. Will he be able to do it once voters get to know him? Or as we've read in some articles that his retail politics aren't the greatest, and it could turn voters off. Mm-hmm. That'll be the test in the coming weeks.
So many tests, as Jeff says, this race just getting underway. All right, next, California Senator Dianne Feinstein returned to the Capitol, but questions remain if she will finish out her term and what California voters are saying, and for the race to replace her in 2024. To retire or not retire? That is the question still swarming around Senator Dianne Feinstein. The 89-year-old California Democrat is vowing to stay in office through her term, despite being confined to a wheelchair as she recovers from a series of health issues. Now, the New York Times reporting, since returning to Washington, Feinstein has missed 6 votes and has not participated in any committee hearings or caucus lunches. And the Washington Post speaking to a divided California Democratic delegates over the weekend. This is from one, from Rosemary Williman. She's just following orders as best she can at this point. She's not herself. Marsha Conant, on the other hand, said it's extraordinary, her career, and I think that's getting minimized, and that makes me angry. Now, Feinstein's issues have been happening for some time. She just suffered shingles and related issues with it afterwards she came back. She didn't deny she had broader health complications, and then she did have broader health complications, as we reported on May 9th. But she also had memory issues that she suffered for some time. She was pushed aside as the top Democrat on the Senate Judiciary Committee. She passed up being the president pro tem, which is for the most senior member of the majority party. Patty Murray now has that. So these are issues that have been that she's been dealing with for some time. Can she sustain this?
So I think there are 2 things at play. And unfortunately, the politics is one of them, and we can't ignore that. We can't ignore that she has a crew, even though she's no longer the top Democrat on Judiciary, she's a crucial deciding vote on that very important committee, especially in this divided government where so much of what Democrats can accomplish is focused on confirming judges and other Biden appointees. So I think Democrats need Feinstein, and there would create a lot of headaches if she were to step down. Governor Newsom doesn't want the headache that would be created if she steps down. And it also seems pretty clear that whether you agree or not, she has decided she does not want to step down. Yeah. But I think the other thing that a lot of people have brought up, there's been some criticism that just from a health standpoint, from a wellness standpoint, should the best thing for Senator Feinstein be to not serve out her term and to just kind of be able to go home and rest and not have the stress of being in the U.S. Senate?
And it's been a staff ordeal. As the New York Times reports, they say that Ms. Feinstein's staff has made sure she is never alone and is heavily protected. The Capitol Police and the Senate Sergeant-at-Arms have gone to great lengths to keep Ms. Feinstein shielded from photographers and reporters, helping to create a bubble around her as aides run interference on her behalf. I mean, I have personally experienced that, too. I've tried to been in positions where we tried to get video of her. They've said that these are places you're not allowed to get video of her. They've tried intentionally trying to avoid press scrutiny. Obviously, this is unusual given the access we typically have on the Hill.
Absolutely. That is extremely rare. And it really does show how cognizant staff, I'm sure her family, those around her are about just general press coverage and how people are seeing her. I mean, it was a shock to so many people when they opened the car door, as you see right there, and she arrived to the Senate for the first time after months. She just looked so frail. The thing about the Senate, though, and you have a really good point about, you know, the votes and just needing to have someone there, tapping someone new would possibly make it a little difficult in terms of timing of votes and, you know, having all those people there. But we've seen this time and time again with a number of senators.
Yeah.
You know, this is not that rare that many of them wish to be there, unfortunately, yeah, until the day they die.
Perfect segue, because this is indeed not an age-old, this is an age-old issue. Look at just a few headlines from the past. 2001, a report about the 100-year-old Strom Thurmond in the office. 2009, from someone named Munaraju at Politico. Preferred illness shows fragile majority, shows my age as well. And then also our industrious reporter, Ted Barrett, on Capitol Hill in October 2017 about Thad Cochran, who ultimately resigned from office. Robert Byrd was 92 after serving 51 years. Nancy Pelosi says it's sexism to go after Feinstein, but this is really an issue that's been happening for so many years.
It definitely has. As long as we've been covering the Hill, the Strom Thurmond ones, you know, most particularly, he, you know, could barely exist. He was living at Walter Reed, if I recall, and still serving the Senate. Look, the difference here is the narrow majority.
Yeah.
And the fact that she serves on an important committee, the Judiciary Committee, as he was saying. So I think that is what's at issue here. If she was simply on other committees, or if it was another senator whose vote wasn't as critical, or if Democrats had more breathing room, we wouldn't be talking about this.
And it's
that is what is different.
And the
here.
Politics in California are so fascinating, because right. you have already have a race to replace her. And if Newsom were to just pick her replacement, he has promised to pick a black woman. Well, there is a black woman in the race, Barbara Lee, and perhaps if he gave her the replacement, could give a leg up against Adam Schiff, who Nancy Pelosi supports, others supports. Katie Porter could give a leg up against her. Who knows if he'd pick Barbara Lee, but still, there are politics at play here, too.
Right, because regardless, he said he'll pick a black woman, which even if it's not Barbara Lee, and quite frankly, it would be hard for him to pick Barbara Lee, given the fact that Adam Schiff and Katie Porter are also in the race, and nobody wants to have that perception as putting their thumb on the scale of such an important Senate seat for Democrats. Mm-hmm. But then if it's not Barbara Lee, then it becomes, well, who is it? And then that creates a whole nother discussion in California. So, again, I think Governor Newsom would rather not have that on his plate. But that means that Senator Feinstein remains in office through 2024.
Yeah, we'll see. The Senate comes back this week. We'll see what happens then. Putin's loyal ally, Belarus, makes a controversial offer to any nation to join their alliance. The reaction live on the ground next. CNN teams on the ground in Ukraine heard multiple loud explosions in Kyiv overnight. And we're learning Ukraine's military says its forces shot down nearly 70 air targets launched against Kyiv. It could be Russia's largest drone attack yet on the capital city. You can see the moment missile debris falls out of the sky and onto oncoming traffic. And this as Belarusian President Lukashenko claims he's offering nuclear weapons to nations willing to join the Union State of Russia and Belarus. But it's not clear how wide his invitation is, and he did not offer any specifics. So let's get to CNN's Sam Kiley, who is live for us in eastern Ukraine. So Sam, explain to us, does Lukashenko even have nuclear weapons to offer?
No, he doesn't, which gives a kind of absurd extra dimension to this offer. Lukashenko's prone to these sorts of statements, as indeed are autocrats the world over, but this is an attempt. I think the non-humorous interpretation is that with a bit of a nudge from the Kremlin, from Vladimir Putin, who does have nuclear weapons, who has got permission of the Belarusians to move tactical nuclear weapons into Belarus to threaten Ukraine and the rest of the world as they come under increasing pressure here, particularly ahead of a potential counteroffensive being launched this summer by Ukraine, that the Belarusian president is hinting to the international community that the arms control treaties and energies that followed the collapse of the Union could be put into reverse with the proliferation of nuclear weapons into those former Soviet countries where Russia still has influence. Manu?
And Sam, let's just get back to a little bit of the latest from what you're seeing on the ground. What are you witnessing about how Ukraine is still vowing to keep up the fight?
Well, Manu, they are continuing with probing attacks across the border. We've saw that over the last week with Russian citizens in the Ukrainian army conducting kind of reconnaissance by force into Russian territory, the first overt move there. We've seen increasing numbers of Ukrainian attacks, particularly using Storm Shadow, the stealth cruise missile supplied by the United Kingdom, again, against Russian targets deep inside occupied Ukrainian territory. There's a growing level of social media campaigning aimed at rattling Russian troops on the ground. And of course, the Russians are countering, though, with efforts to attack Ukraine's capacity to generate aircraft, for example, to fight back against them. The Russians claiming without any kind of evidence at all that they struck a number of airfields overnight, for example, Manu.
Sam Kiley from Eastern Ukraine, thank you for your reporting. Stay safe out there. Grateful for what you're doing on the ground. And now, up next for us, vulnerable Republican candidates gearing up for 2024 seats that are competitive in the House. And they're looking to distance themselves from Donald Trump and hang on to that very slim majority. How who's at the top of the ticket could make a big difference next. Now, the GOP presidential primary will not be the only brutal political fight in 2024. Republicans also want to expand their narrowly won House majority. But there's fear of a Trump drag for Republicans down ticket. Cook Political Report editor-in-chief Amy Walter writes, in 2022, Democrats effectively branded the GOP as a party of MAGA and Trump, helping them pick up a Senate seat, and hold down their losses in the House. This is why many Republicans are correctly worried that Trump on the top of the ticket could risk their majority. Now, our panel is back. The Trump drag is real. It is a real concern that we hear oftentimes. And there are a lot of vulnerable Republican freshmen who won seats despite Trump losing in those districts. Just look at some of them. You see Congressman George Santos being one of them. So he won his seat by 7.5 points. Obviously, he's got much different issues now. He's been indicted and he is facing an ethics investigation. But there are others, too, other New York Republicans who barely won their races. Someone from New Jersey, like Tom Kane Jr., and others from the coasts in Oregon, California, and also a Virginia district, Jen Kiggins. This is a real concern. In a 222 seat, Republicans have 222 seats, 213 Democrats. Trump could just drag down enough of these members to flip the House.
Absolutely. The number that House Democrats are looking for is 5. They just need 5 seats. You could easily just get that from New York itself. The one thing, just looking at all of those members that you put up, I don't think any of them had top ticket Senate or governors who were problematic. If you talk to the NRCC, who is in charge of protecting this Republican majority in their campaigns, they all point to that. A number of seats that were winnable that they really thought that they were going to get, they had issues because of whoever the governor choice was or the top Republican senator was, all of whom were more or less Trump-endorsed candidates. So what Richard Hudson, who is the chairman of the NRCC, is really reminding members is, keep it local. Mm-hmm. Try as much as possible not to talk about the national, you know, get into whatever presidential nominees might be trying to spin and spit at each other on a current day. Focus on what we've been able to get done, mm-hmm. keeping the economy at bay, fighting against inflation, cutting spending. That's what they're hoping.
And ignore all the noise.
Ignore the noise, which is very hard.
Easier said than done in a midterm election than a presidential race. The reality here is, I mean, I'm on one side, the Trump supporters will come out. If he's on the top of the ticket, this is not going to be a midterm like 2018 or 2022. Republicans will come out, those Trump supporters. But to also look at the president's approval rating. Not so hot either. So I think a fair and balanced look at this would say that some Democrats aren't necessarily thrilled with what President Biden is going to do for their ticket. So it's just going to be ugly if it's a rematch. But we do not know if it will be a rematch. Donald Trump is the leading candidate. not the presumptive nominee. So we just have to sort of be patient and to go through this. But look at where those people are from, as you were saying.
Yeah.
New Jersey, New York, et cetera. So the seats are there.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I just want to add, you know, one of the X factors with Trump, if he's at the top of the ticket, is we don't know what he's going to say about the mechanics of elections themselves. Mm-hmm. We saw that happen in Georgia, where he actually was telling people, your vote's not going to count, I don't trust the system, and that further depressed turnout. Now, even with his name on the ballot, he's already saying similar things. He's still trying to relitigate 2020. Mm-hmm. How will that affect turnout? How will that possibly energize those who might not want to support Trump and Republicans on the ballot? So a lot will also just, to me, depend on kind of the atmosphere around the election, whether that's Trump or even another nominee who might be just as conservative, the Ron DeSantis's of the world, talking about wokeism and book bans. That might not play as well in a state like New York.
Look, there are lots of issues at play in races. The presidential race will have a huge impact on this. But there's also other issues like redistricting in North Carolina that's gone in Republicans' favor that could help them pick up some more seats, that could change the dynamics as well. But the trend is real. I mean, look at Trump at the top of the ticket in 2016. Republican candidates who won in districts that Trump lost, 23 of them won in 2016. Just nine in 2020. It's an issue for the Senate races, too. Places that there are Trump states that that are key here, but there are also some purple states like Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, that Michigan, where Trump on the ballot could hurt their Senate candidates, too.
Absolutely. And those are those states that we saw in the midterms that we saw were very swingy, where voters were, you know, no longer Republican, or if they were Republican, they just didn't like Trump. Like Trumpism, a number of those principles, but they didn't like him. And that really did influence how they voted on some of those governors and Republican senators, saying, you know what, this is too much for me. Let's try and go back to stability. And Biden has been making that argument for a very long time. Of course, he has a presidential record now, which he didn't have before. But he always says, you know, do not compare me to the almighty. Compare me to the alternative. And you're going to just see Democrats continue to say, that's the difference. Yeah. It's MAGA Republicans or this Democratic.
But you're also hearing that from Republicans, too, concerned about Trump. Yeah, he could do well in the primary, but how can he do in a general election? Senator John Cornyn has been one of those who has spoken out against that. Others may as well. That would also be an argument in the primary campaign. Now, a quick programming note. Sunday night live from Iowa, Jake Tapper moderates a CNN Republican presidential town hall with former South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley. The evening kicks off Sunday at 8 p.m. Eastern, only on CNN. Next, President Biden and the country mark Memorial Day, a time to honor and remember those who have fallen in service to the nation. Today, President Biden honoring our fallen heroes, the Commander-in-Chief taking part in Memorial Day ceremonies at Arlington National Cemetery. You see him there laying a wreath at the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier. Vice President Kamala Harris and Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin were also participating. The president later paying tribute to Gold Star families, calling on the memory of his late son, Beau, who served in the military before dying of cancer. Tomorrow marks the anniversary of his death. Thanks for joining Inside Politics. CNN News Central starts right now.
Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Now streaming exclusively on Max, a new CNN flash doc about the album that has Nashville talking, Call Me Country. Beyoncé and Nashville's Renaissance. Watch it at max.com/callmecountry. Max subscription required.